When her estranged husband was killed in their garage by masked men, she was also injured in the process. But the police started to look more closely at her as a suspect when she took off from Mexico with her boyfriend even before the funeral could happen. But should her trial have focused on the many times she cheated in her marriage? And should the prosecution have been allowed to make a titillating show of her undergarments? This is the story of Brenda Andrew, the woman who might just be on death row because people thought she was a slut. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here. I'm a Midwesterner who now lives in New York City, putting my writing degree to use by researching true crime cases that interest me, and hopefully you. And hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. A headline about this case hooked me, and I just couldn't resist finding out more. Supreme Court rules in favor of only woman on Oklahoma death row. Of course, as I got into it, I saw even more compelling headlines like Brenda Andrew, sex shamed to death in Oklahoma. But let's start at the beginning, November 20th, 2001, when Robert D. Andrew tragically died near Oklahoma City. Two masked men dressed in black had attacked him in his own garage, or so his wife said. 39-year-old Rob and 37-year-old Brenda had been together since they met at the local swimming pool when she was a senior in high school. But they had recently separated after 17 years of marriage, and he had recently moved into his own apartment. When Rob came to pick up their kids at 6:20 p.m. for Thanksgiving vacation, he was shot twice, and Brenda was shot once in the arm. A neighbor heard a woman scream, but no one saw anything, especially not anyone fleeing the scene. Still, investigators were treating it like a home invasion and murder at first. But Brenda's wound was superficial, and although she told the police that the masked men got her with a shotgun as she tried to run into the house, the weapon actually used to shoot her was a .22 caliber, fired at close range. But by the time she was viewed as a suspect, she had taken her two kids and driven to Mexico with her boyfriend. Brenda had met James Pavott at church in 1999, and their families became dinner friends and Bible study friends. Advertising executive Rob and insurance salesman James even went on hunting trips together. Then Brenda and James started teaching Sunday school together. Then James helped them take out an $800,000 life insurance policy on Rob. Then James got a divorce in the summer of 2001. Then Brenda asked for one, too. She and James left for Mexico before they could even go to Rob's funeral. When they ran out of money and had to come back to the U.S. in February 2002, they were arrested on conspiracy and first-degree capital murder charges. James Pavott went on trial in August 2003, 6 months before Brenda did, and boy was the evidence against him. Like, Rob had been coming over to supposedly help Brenda reignite the pilot light on the furnace and pick up their kids. But the kids hadn't been packed to leave and were in fact found watching TV with the volume up really high, almost as if to mask the sound of a murder that was about to take place in their garage. Pavott's daughter testified that he told her Brenda had asked him to kill Rob. She also said that her dad asked her to call Rob one morning in October 2001 and tell him that Brenda was in the hospital and he needed to go to her. It turns out that Pavott and Brenda had cut the brake lines on Rob's car and hoped that this fake emergency would make him drive too fast to survive the tampering. Luckily, Rob immediately realized that he was in danger when he took off, and he called his mechanic and the police. Recognizing who was probably trying to hurt him, he tried to get Brenda off of his life insurance policy. But Pavott, who had sold it to the couple, lied and said that Rob couldn't change anything because Brenda was listed as the owner of the policy. Rob actually was the owner, but seeing that Rob was on to them, Pavott and Brenda secretly forged his signature and changed the ownership behind Rob's back so he really couldn't take Brenda off the policy. And then he was killed less than a month later. There were other things, like the fact that when Brenda was getting treated for her wound at the hospital the night of the shooting, a witness described her as giddily chatting with Pavott. The shotgun that killed Rob was apparently an unusual gauge and happened to be a gauge of shotgun that Rob himself owned. He told friends that Brenda wouldn't let him have the gun in their separation, yet when the police searched the house, it was nowhere to be seen. Brenda had been doing target practice a week before the murder at a family home, though, and the same gauge of shotgun shells were found at her practice site. Also, a week before the murder, Pavat bought a .22 caliber gun, the same kind used to injure Brenda. And the day of the murder, he told his daughter he was going to take her car in for servicing, but when he returned it to her, it hadn't been serviced, and it had a .22 caliber bullet on the floor. He told his daughter he'd kill her if she told anyone. Tell me if you're getting bored here, because this guy so obviously did it. Pavat was found guilty of first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit first-degree murder. The jury found that Rob's manner of death was especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel because he was still conscious for several minutes after he was shot, and Pavat was sentenced to death. At Brenda's trial in July 2004, the evidence was more or less the same. The cut brake lines, the life insurance fraud, everything Pavat's daughter knew and was asked to do. Rob's brother even testified that they were going to try to go on a hunting trip over Thanksgiving, but Rob was anxious because Brenda wouldn't give him back his shotgun with the unusual gauge that happened to be the same gauge that killed Rob. Jurors were shown photographs of a tear in Rob's neck from the shotgun blast that was the size of a fist, and were told that he died slowly from the blood loss, slowly and painfully. It's like they really didn't need to do anything else to make Brenda look guilty, and I'm sure the jury was already against her. But I think the prosecution wanted not to just convict her, but to shame her. As soon as Brenda was arrested, the press started talking about her many and varied extramarital affairs. People magazine published an article where a coworker said Rob pointed out a motel where he caught Brenda hooking up with an ex when they were already engaged. At her trial, the prosecution read an entry from Rob's journal where he talked about going to surprise her at college and finding out she'd been sleeping in her ex's dorm room. They also read about how she was teaching at a summer camp one year and started dating a man she met there even though she was about to marry Rob. His journal entry was from 1984, showing that Brenda had been cheating on him for years and years. A man she'd had an affair with took the stand and said she told him she wanted Rob dead. The prosecution made sure to ask him about all the different places Brenda wanted to have sex, like her car and motel rooms. They made sure to have him note that she paid for the motels, you know, like only a slut would. The police even found a book in her dresser drawer, 203 Ways to Drive a Man Wild in Bed. Not just 200 ways, you guys, but 203. The jury only took one day to convict her, and Brenda Andrew was sentenced to death. One law professor told the LA Times that it's easier to convince a jury that women suffer emotional distress or other emotional problems more than men, and that's why we see so many more men on death row. Like, women are fragile, you can't execute them for their emotional weakness. But when we do choose to execute women, there's a theory from the same law professor that it's because they've committed shockingly unladylike behavior that has offended society's sensibilities about what we should expect from girls. And therefore, we have to execute them as a form of social cleansing to put humanity right again. They call this the evil woman theory. And obviously Brenda was evil if Pavat was only one of her many lovers. If she was cheating with one guy and also hitting on his adult son. If someone at a bar called her a hoochie because of how she dressed. One witness said she had the audacity to run errands wearing a leather skirt and really, really big hair. Funny how sometimes your high hair brings you closer to God, and sometimes it makes you a whore. The prosecution saved its real smoking gun for the very last moments of the trial, though. Earlier, they had shown the jury the suitcases Brenda and James had taken on their escape to Mexico. Now they opened Brenda's suitcase and revealed that she had packed thong underwear and lace bras, hardly the trappings of a grieving widow. They called her a slut puppy. It was pretty wild on many levels, but the main one is that it just didn't seem necessary. I mean, her boyfriend had already been sentenced to death on the exact same evidence, so wouldn't they have likely gotten the same sentence for Brenda, whether she wore granny panties or not? Or is one boyfriend not enough to make you evil? She was found guilty and sentenced to death. After her trial, Brenda went to the Oklahoma Court of Criminal Appeals, who said that the whole parade of her skivvies was completely fine. They did take issue, though, with how much time was spent on Brenda wearing leather skirts and changing her hair color to suit whatever young man she was flirting with at the moment. They said those things had nothing to do with the murder. One judge said that the evidence was only meant to make Brenda look like a bad wife, a bad mother and a bad woman, and that the jury wasn't there to decide if she was bad, just if she was a killer. Another judge said that she should get a new trial, but the court's majority opinion was that these were harmless errors that didn't affect the verdict. Brenda then went in front of the Federal District Court of Western Oklahoma, and they said that, okay, maybe her trial included testimony from a guy who probably shouldn't have even been there because their affair had ended 4 entire years prior to the murder. But, they said, the prosecution only asked him one singular question about dating Brenda, and also, this man ended up testifying that Brenda hated her husband and wanted him dead, so thank goodness he was put on the stand. So basically, quit asking questions. Brenda's trial was totally fair. The only thing is that the prosecution actually asked a whole series of questions about the affair with this guy from years ago. They left the topic and then came back to it to drive home how immoral Brenda was. And when they asked this guy if Brenda wanted her husband dead, he said she never told him anything to that effect. And yet the court wrote that he said she wanted Rob dead? Did they even read the trial transcript at all? They denied Brenda's appeal on every count and also said that no reasonable juror would ever find her case debatable. Basically, it's over. The appeals stop here. But Brenda didn't stop. In March 2023, a federal appeals court heard her case and said that although her trial was imperfect, it was fundamentally fair. The quote-unquote evidence of her guilt was overwhelming. But in January 2025, she appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they actually sided with her. The majority opinion said that the evidence about Brenda's personal life was irrelevant and that this highly prejudicial evidence actually hadn't allowed the trial to be fair. They ordered a lower court to review her case. But then in January 2026, that lower court said, nope, 62-year-old Brenda is right where she belongs. That the evidence still points to her guilt, whether or not you care about how revealing her grocery store outfits were. Brenda can still request a new trial from the Supreme Court, but it's unclear if they would ever go that far. She may still be executed. We just have to wait and see. 72-year-old James Pavad is also still on death row, and Brenda Andrew still maintains her innocence. So this case is interesting to me partly because I'm a little torn about how I feel. Law scholars talk about how it's an issue of gender inequality, the way Brenda was painted at trial. No one called James Pavad a slut puppy and talked about him being a bad father because he was out hooking up with Brenda. His trial was based on the evidence. But on the other hand, and you've probably heard me say this before, I'm a little okay with whatever the journey is when I think the destination is correct. I absolutely think it's gross that the prosecution was showing off Brenda's underwear to prove a point about her loose morals, but I'm also pretty sure I believe the evidence pointed to her being guilty. And if her co-conspirator got the death penalty, there's no reason she shouldn't have too. But as always, I'm interested in your opinion about this. As wild as this case is, I loved reading about what a likable guy Rob Andrew was. Like the Oklahoman wrote that on July 11th, he brought slushies to everyone in his office because he decided that it was 7-Eleven day. And he joked that he named his daughter Tricity so that if she ever ran for office, her slogan could be Electricity. These are exactly the kind of dad jokes that I live for. He said that Green Eggs and Ham was the best business book in the world because the main character can sell anything to anyone, including green eggs. Adorable. It's just so sad for him that he married a woman who was raised so buttoned up that she wanted to get real buttoned down outside of their marriage. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.